Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
And getting it is pretty hard from the front of the boat. When you're on the back of the boat, you tend to really see the whole deal and know what's going on. From the front of the boat, if you've only been in the front of the boat, it's kind of tough for these guys, I think, to watch the whole game go down and, mm-hmm. and anticipating things. But I think what it takes is getting in the back of the boat.
This is the Tom Rowland Podcast. Fascinating stories to amaze, encourage, and inspire you in fishing, fitness, and the outdoors. And we're brought to you by Black Rifle Coffee. I started this podcast as a way to connect with my friends, people that I admire and respect, and you. It has been a learning journey that's made me a better person, a better fisherman, a better father, and a better athlete. I'm so happy that you're on this journey with me, and I'd love to hear from you with show suggestions, guest suggestions, or questions. The best way to get a hold of me is through text. You can text 305-930-7346 for the fastest response, but if you prefer to email, you can send that to podcast@saltwaterexperience.com. That's a dedicated email address just for the show. If you like this show, you can show your support by posting about it on social media and tagging me. Text the link to a couple of friends that may also enjoy it, and subscribe and leave a 5-star review if you feel like I've earned it. The website is TomRowlandPodcast.com, and that is where everything lives. All past shows, you can go and listen to any show. You can look up all the different shows that we've done, both the How-To Tuesdays, the Full Links, and the Physical Fridays. They all live on TomRowlandPodcast.com. And the social media is Tom_Rowland, R-O-W-L-A-N-D, on Instagram. Or you can go to our big account, Saltwater_Experience. I hope to hear from you soon. So now, let's get on to today's show.
This is Paul Tejera on the Tom Rowland Podcast.
How you been doing, Paul?
I've been doing great. Life is wonderful.
It is. I just saw you got your daughter just got married. That's pretty amazing day in your life. I'm not there yet.
Got her married off to a great guy, and we're all super happy about it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Time flies, doesn't it, man? I swear. I saw that. I saw your post that your daughter just got married, and I was like, man, it seems like yesterday that we were hanging around a Redbone tournament or something. Like, I mean, before I even thought about having kids, and my kids are, I mean, we're empty nesters. I'm not quite to your level yet of having one married off, but both my boys are living in Montana. My daughter's now at college, and wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you believe that?
So they're about the same age.
Yeah. How old's your daughter?
Yeah. 24.
Okay. So my oldest son's 23. And then I got a 21 and my daughter's 18. So yeah, it happens fast, man.
Great. Yeah, that's great.
Did you manage to hold it together on the, I can only imagine. Yes. That a big tough guy like you would not be able to hold it together. Yeah. Just like I'm not going to be able to hold it together.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I thought I was going to. And I was given a speech at the thing, and I was recapping like my life with my daughter, and out of nowhere, you know, it just got emotional. You know, dude. I was like, man, I didn't know I had that in me, you know. But I did.
I know. It's, I don't know. Occasionally when it happened with me, when we were dropping my daughter off at college and the whole time my wife is having like, you know, she's having a hard time with the thing. I'm having no problem with it. I'm like, yeah, this is just the next thing. She's just going to college. And then all of a sudden we're about to say goodbye to her and holy cow, I didn't know it was in there. And it just came flying out. And I looked like every other dad in front of the dorm leaving my daughter at school for the last time.
Exactly. Like,
it was terrible, man. But anyway, that's a big day, man. That's our careers have moved and changed and shifted as our lives have. And I love watching you doing all these different things, like especially tennis.
Yeah.
What's going on with the tennis? You're obviously very good at it.
Well, I played a lot in my 20s. That was my sport after college. I played baseball in college. And then after college, I took up tennis just to have a competition, you know, have some competition. And I played all through my 20s and I got highly ranked in the state of Florida at that time. And then as soon as I moved to the Keys, I dropped the game and I hadn't played in 30 years.
Yeah, really? So 30 years.
So I came back to the game after, you know, having a stint with snowboarding and kiteboarding and of course fishing every day, and some surfing. And then I said, you know what? I need something to fuel me to really get me working out more and doing more again and have a reason to do it. Yeah. You know, so I got into it right before COVID actually. Started competing again. And then I realized that, hey, my 63-year-old body is not, it is in better shape than other guys' 63-year-old bodies because I don't have the injuries.
Right.
All these guys that kept playing all along, they all had knee surgeries and different things. And I just came off a shoulder surgery. So, I kind of know what that's like, but luckily it was my left side. So it was good. But yeah, it's great to see, you know, competing against people my age and then younger.
Is that how it works? What are the age groups that you compete in?
So this past weekend I played in a 55s tournament. So you have to be 55 to compete in that one. And I won that one this past week. But then I'm ranked second in the state in the over 18s.
Wow. So, second in the state in the over 18s.
Yeah. And that's in a 4.0 division. So it's in a division, which isn't the highest. 5.0 is the highest and 4.0 is next.
Kind of like a handicap in golf, kind of a little bit.
Kind of like that. But I figure with my age, I'm still competing against 30-year-olds and stuff.
You're killing it. That's amazing. What was that first day like getting back on the court after 30 years?
You know, I just started by hitting balls with a couple of guys locally and, some of the fishing guides that, you know, Chuck Schaffstall played mm-hmm. tennis and then a couple of the other guides and we just went out and just hit balls and just had fun. And I started realizing, man, I haven't really forgotten much, yeah. You know, it's just a matter of moving my feet. I forgot how to move my feet. But that's about it. And then I just started playing and then, you know, just finding people to compete with.
I used to see Todd Bowen. He used to play tennis in Key West. He had that van. It was a very unique van and he would fish and then he would go straight to the tennis court every day. And that van would be there every day, man. He would play and he must've been a good player. But he's gotta be getting pretty old these days, but, he had the bug. Too. Yeah, but it's something about that competitive fire, you know, like you were an athlete. You said you played baseball. I was a wrestler. And I got away from competition for a while. And then the fishing tournaments for me were like, wow. Like that, like what I was asking about that first day on the court, or maybe it's your first tournament or something to where you get that, you get that fire back. Like, oh, I've been missing this. And I found that in the first fishing tournament that I ever was in. And I think it was a Redbone or Slam, you know, and I went there and I had no idea what to expect. And that was in the heyday of those tournaments, you know, there were probably 90 boats in there and
Sure.
And all these people I'd heard of, and it was just amazing. I was like, oh my God, this is like a boat race. And it's like, it's like homecoming, and it's like seeing all my heroes, and it's this competition. And it just, I was just like, man, I got to have more. I got to have more of that. Of course, where you come from, Isla Mirada is the home of the tournaments. We didn't have very many tournaments in Key West, but back then we didn't. But your tournament career, man, that's you had quite a career, man. And probably still are. Do you still fish the tournaments, or do you have any desire to?
I quit fishing tournaments last year. 2 years ago was my last Gold Cup and all that stuff. So I kind of eased away from that because you know, I moved on to other things and I want some more time, and I'm, you know, heading into my tail end of my career as far as fishing, and it's fun to have a little bit more free time.
The, you're moving into the tail end of your career, maybe as far as fishing, but it seems like you have you've always had other things going on. Like you had the jig company. You probably still do have the jig company.
No, I'll close that one too.
Really? Okay. Yeah. Well, I have a whole bunch of them that you sent me, that I guard with my life. It's like, man, I don't let it. I have a special tackle box of the Backbone jigs that I don't let anybody, they go.
I still got a reserve stock for you.
Do you?
I got a reserve stock for you. Yeah.
So, what about that jig company? How did that start for you?
You know, it was one of those things where I had a need, and there was nothing out there of what I wanted. And so I decided to design one myself, make the molds. I was already tying flies at that point, so tying them was no problem. And I started tying some, and I showed them to a tackle shop, and one of the tackle shops wanted them. So I found a way to mass produce them in Guatemala, and that's where my factory was. And we just went on from there, and it was never a big, huge money maker or anything, because you got to be so big in the lure business in order to make any money. But it definitely satisfied, you know, the need of having good lures to work in the backcountry, and lures that were weedless and worked well, and, you know, were designed like flies.
Yeah. They were awesome, man. I love those jigs. And then now you're moving into real estate. You have been for quite a while now, right?
I've been for 7 years, and it's been a real easy move over to that, because it's just a, you know, like you, we all have our clients that trust us and follow us. And then all the fishing guides around here trust me and know me and know that, you know, I'm not here to take any clients away from them or anything like that, especially as far as fishing. I mean, there's nothing. It's been a real nice move for me, and God, and with this market, it's, you know, a really nice move. So everything's worked out super well.
There's so many anglers that I can think of over the years that came down, liked it, got the bug, and then bought houses. Like, that's kind of a thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I gave a lot of that away, as you did, for many years. And then I just decided, you know what, I know this place as well as anyone. So I might as well take advantage of that.
And you're outside of the contacts, your fishing career, has it helped you, in other ways in the real estate business?
Sure. I mean, that's one of the things, one of the, downfalls of it was that I was a fishing guide. And so I had to kind of prove to people that, hey, now he's a realtor, you know, also, mm-hmm. because not everybody wants to buy a house from their fishing guide.
Right.
So it's one of those things where I had to make that transition. But I think by now, people have realized that, you know, I've closed enough deals and done enough.
What do you think was the hardest part about that? Like, convincing people that you were serious about it, or that you could do it, or was it something else?
Yeah, I think it was that. I think it was that that I was going to be in that for a while, and maybe, you know, reputable enough in that field, and knowledgeable enough, actually. And, you know, so the first thing I had to do was learn that contract really good. I mean, better than the people that have been doing it for 20 years learned it. So I wanted to make sure that there was no questions and nothing I couldn't answer, you know. And, you know, it comes back to the same old thing. You want to do everything the best that you can. And, That's kind of something that you and I have always had in common.
Yeah. Does it feel good to have a little reprieve from the sun?
Sure, sure. And it's not much. It's to the point now where at least I can take weekends off, you know, and not worry about fishing weekends. And I fish my own clientele and fish them, you know, 5 days a week during the season. And then the rest of the year, I kind of patch up different things and make deals and just kind of go with whatever's happening that day.
That sounds like the perfect, I've always thought being a realtor and a fishing guide would be like the perfect mix. I even wanted my wife, even just to get her real estate license, because, you know, a lot of people don't realize that you can't, if you have a hot client that wants to buy a compound in Isla Mirada and I pass them off to a realtor, I don't mm-hmm. get anything from that. But if someone has a real estate license, you could actually just get a commission. And I was trying to convince my wife to take the license because it was happening so frequently that people, my clients, my customers were coming down and buying houses in Key West that I was like, look, we're losing all this money. You don't even have to sell a house. Just give the referral. Just
be there.
Yeah. And we never made it work, but you know, it's,
and it's true. You know, they all the guys trust you and they're on the boat with you all the time and they're going to ask you anyway.
Yeah.
They're going to ask you, hey, what do you think about this house here in Key West? Do you think that street's good?
Yeah,
what,
exactly. You know, let's get off the water a little bit early today. I want you to go check this place out with me. Like that's how it went a lot. And I was like, boy, this is a nice house.
that's how it started with me. And now sometimes we come back from a fishing day and the guy says, hey, what about going by that house that you showed me, you know? And I go, okay, take the water tour. You know, you just go right by, say, this is the place. This is why you want this place and not an oceanside place or whatever, you know? Right. So it really makes a difference.
Man, that's awesome. Well, kudos to you for doing that and making that move because, you know, some people don't and they don't have much when they decide that their career is winding down, right? Like they waited too long and it's like, okay, your career's winding down, but now what? And did you save the money that you should have saved? And you know,
it's hard for us.
It is hard, man, because all good fishing guides are personalities. They are the captain. We would probably be the worst employees that there would ever be, right? You know what I mean? It's not a recipe for being a great employee to have the background.
And especially after doing it a while.
Right.
Forget it. You'd be a horrible employee.
So you got to figure out something that you can do on your own. And and then, you know, it's the same kind of thing. Like what you were getting to before. Like if you're going to do something, then you want to be really good at it. You want to put your heart and soul into it. So it needs to be something that you can really get behind. And it's a perfect thing for you. That's awesome.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's awesome. Thank you. You're an interesting dude, man, because when I first met you, it was in the, you know, in those early days of the fishing tournaments and I was so nervous. And I was, and those, like the tournaments made me, it gave me a feeling than I wanted again, which was the feeling of competition.
Midway USA brand product designers have one straightforward goal, develop high quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7. With super fast shipping, MidwayUSA.com. At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on, and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
But I would go in, and I felt like I knew less than anyone there, especially when I would come up to Isla Mirada, and I had no idea what I was doing up there. And I was just so nervous. And those weekends would be just so full of anxiety and nervousness. But then when it was over, I would look back on it. I was like, that was awesome. I'm going to do it again. But leading up to it, there would be so much. And then I would meet you up there, and you just always had this smile on your face. You're just, you never seemed to let it bother you. And I even remember today going, man, I need to be more like that. Like, how do you get like that? I mean, is it just because you're 10 years older than me and you had 10 years more experience, or is that's just you? I think like you're just,
that's just me. I'm pretty happy and always smiling and, you know, always see the better side, but you are like that. So that's not true. You're always the same, and you're always level headed and,
well,
and
I try calm. To be, so, try to so, be, but inside sometimes I'm super nervous.
Yeah. But we became friends right away. And I knew that from the beginning, and that was one of those connections where I like, you know, we might not ever talk to each other for 4 or 5 years or whatever it is. And then we can talk to each other like best friends. It's really a mutual respect thing.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Well, I respected the way that you were able to just, man, you just seemed like you were having a lot more fun than I was. And I was like, man, I got to figure out how this is going to be more fun, or I'm not going to be able to do it very long. But your career, I've got it right here. Oh. You've got, you're the only one of the few to win all three, right? Here it is. Right. One of the few to win all three major tarpon tournaments, the Gold Cup, the Don Holly, two all tackles, spring fly, and you cashed a nice check on that one tournament that they had, the biggest bonefish, $25,000. And then the other thing that I see here is Best of the West fly casting competition, which is another thing that we have in common.
Freaking weird. You won that one too, huh?
In Denver. You know why?
Oh, cool.
Because the air's thin out there, dude. And we're used to casting it in 100% humidity. And you go out there and all of a sudden it flies, right?
Yeah.
It flies.
Yeah, not only that, there's no wind inside the auditorium.
I know. They just, the trick to that one was having enough back cast space because, you know,
right.
Some of those they would have, you know, stuff behind you, and it was really tough, but I only won one. I was going up against some pretty tough competition.
Oh, yeah.
Brian O'Keefe, I don't know if he was still doing it when you were doing it, but man, that guy, of everyone that I know and have ever seen cast, he is the most beautiful fly caster I've ever seen. Brian O'Keefe, the photographer. A lot of people know him as a great photographer. They don't know that he is a really, really, really good fly caster. And he just had this way, and it just looked like he was barely even, I'm out there sweating and double hauling and like Lefty double said, hauling. Ripping your underwear when you're double hauling and everything. And he would just stand there and just whoosh, and that thing would fly. And, you know, the Ray Jeff brothers were there and all those guys. And,
the year I won was the year that Steve Ray Jeff didn't make it to the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And
better capitalize on that one.
Yeah. But that was it. That was my only year ever there. And the funny part about the whole thing was that all the other guys were like licking their chops because Steve Ray Jeff wasn't there. And it's like, oh, it's my turn.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. It's my turn to win this thing. And here comes Paul Tejera from Isla Mirada. They didn't know from Adam.
Guy's probably never held a 5-weight in his life.
Never. Yeah, exactly. And never even casted a 5-weight before and beat those guys. So it was kind of a fun deal.
Yeah. You do a lot of casting instruction nowadays, right? Like you're still working with Sandy in his school or?
Yeah. Yep. Right now the main core of guys is Sandy Moret and Chico, of course. Steve Huff is usually around, but sometimes not as much now. And then Rob Fordyce and I.
That's cool.
So that's kind of like the main core.
Now Chico, he's another one that has a beautiful casting style. Dude,
beautiful.
Slippery as butter. He just throws it out there. It looks like he really looks like he's not working very hard at it. That's what you always say about anybody that's good at anything, is it doesn't look like they're working very hard.
Exactly.
And he has that loop that kind of it kind of like drops underneath and it just I've figured out a way to do it. Like after I saw him cast, I was like, I wonder if I could do that. And so I figured out how to do it. And it's not my casting style, but I can emulate his cast and make it do that. But he is a beautiful fly caster.
Oh, he is. I still record him. Almost every fly school that we do, I still record them and I show them. I said, man, you look so good, so smooth, Rico Suave, you know? And he's just a cool dude all the way around.
Yeah, he is. Sure. He is. He was with Scott Fly Rods back in the early days and I had an opportunity to fish with him a few times and he didn't disappoint. I was like, you know, you get one of those guys on the boat, right? And you're just kind of like, what is this going to be like? Like, is this, you know, I've read this guy's books. I've seen his videos. Like, is he going to disappoint? Is he going to be better than I thought he was? And a guy like Chico, he gets up there and you're just like, yep, he's just as good as I thought he was going to be.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Moose. That's my dog, Moose. What do you think? Like, you've had the opportunity to fish with so many different anglers and customers and, you know, the who's who. What do you think as far as an angler goes, what does it take to be like somebody that when they walk away, the guide's like, that's one of the best guys I've ever fished with?
Yeah. Yeah. First person that comes to mind is Andy Mill. You know, he just, he gets it, you know, and getting it is pretty hard from the front of the boat. When you're on the back of the boat, you tend to really see the whole deal and know what's going on from the front of the boat. If you've only been in the front of the boat, it's kind of tough for these guys, I think, to watch the whole game go down and anticipating things. But I think what it takes is getting in the back of the boat.
That's really interesting perspective. And honestly, I haven't heard many people say that before, but that is very true. Like some of the best anglers that I know are guides. They may not be the best casters that I have, but they know how to put it where it belongs. And then you take like the best tarpon anglers that everybody gives credit to. Andy Mill is one of the very best of all time. Fitz Coker's another one of the very best of all time. He spent plenty of time on the back of the boat taking, even if it's just taking friends fishing, right? It's like, you understand, okay, this boat is not going to stop on a dime like I think, like I want it to, or we need it to. So I'm going to need to make this cast sooner because we're going to drift to a stop, or the guide's going to do his best to stop the boat, but there's still going to be some forward motion. So you better make that cast faster. But it's also about like being able to see the fish like really well. That's what I think is like with so many of the best anglers that I've had. It's like you point out a fish and they're like, oh yeah, that's it. It's so fast. You're like, no, but point your rod. Like, make sure that, are you looking at what I'm looking at? Because you said it like that. And they're like, yeah, right there. And you're like, right there at like 140 feet. Yeah. Yeah. Right there. That's it. That's it right there. And you're like, okay, this is going to be a great day. This guy can see, right?
Exactly.
What else does an angler like Andy Mill do that other anglers don't do or have a difficult time doing?
I think that he just gets entrenched in it. You know, again, top athlete, you know, world-class athlete. He knows how to study and work towards getting better and to do things. You know, he's been on the front of the boat. He's been on the back of the boat. He kind of analyzes things, thinks about it. It becomes his job. It becomes his life, you know, for a guy like that. So when somebody like that comes around, you know, it's special and different, but there's plenty of anglers that have gotten there, to a really high level just by really trying to learn the whole thing. Not only just how to cast, but learning spots. And, you know, the spots that the guides take them to, whoever their guide may be, you know, fish is the same terrain, over and over again, and they get to see it. They would know, you know, when the tide's coming in or out, or which direction the fish are going to come in and stuff. They don't need to be told all the time. And when they actually really study it, like a guide studies it, then that's when they get to the next level, you know? And,
right.
And most of it is the anticipation, like, you know, anticipation of a fish that's coming across and where the fly needs to be. And all that whole game is one of those things that you just don't make it up. You know, you can't buy it.
Right.
You got to see it.
Do you think it's important to do other types of fishing or fish with other guides in other areas, or can somebody make it, like starting with one guide and staying with that guide the whole time?
Depends on the guide.
It does. Yeah. You know, Richard Black, he fishes everywhere. So if you're fishing with somebody like that, yeah, he's going to put you in all of these different positions. But, you know, I would exactly. definitely have anglers that would fish with me, and then they would go and they would experience these different things with other guides, and they would come back and they would tell me these stories, and then we could like apply it. Then I would see him apply what he had learned somewhere else to this situation. And I'm like, wow. That's pretty good.
Well, that's good. You know, especially if they're fishing with really good guides in different places, you know, that are helpful and can help them. You know, we tell the guys at the fly school all the time, everybody that comes out of that fly school, is because we set them up with guides for a couple of days after the school. And they're pretty much newbies. They've never done it before. And we tell them, I said, you know, if it doesn't click with your guide, switch guides, try another guide, because it's got to click. It's got to be a good connection there where you're going to learn from this guy. It's somebody that's willing to teach you and show you things, because, you know, it'll just cut the curve down, you know, the learning curve.
Right. So that clicking, not only does that mean that you're having fun, but you're learning and you're catching fish and do you think that it's real obvious to somebody that is just getting into the sport and like what clicking?
No.
What if they haven't fished with many guides? Like, how do you know that you're clicking with your guide?
Yeah, no, it's not obvious sometimes. And yeah, it's not obvious. But what we try to tell them is that that you've got to see the guy making an effort. An effort to, you know, it might not be a day where you're seeing a lot of fish, but he's making that effort. He's making moves. He's thinking. You can tell when a guide's thinking. You can tell when a guide is, you know, oh man, a little stumped sometimes, you know, we get stumped all the time. And it's like, well, God, I got to make this move. And sometimes you'll run 10 miles to go to different water, that kind of stuff, that they're willing to do that and not camping you out on a spot where there's no fish and you're just sitting there and he's just wasting time, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So. There's also a bit of entertainment and, you know,
yes.
Simon Becker used to tell me that there was a, we would see certain guides that would scream at their customers, you know, they would just scream at them. Like the old Florida Keys, like the nightmare guide, right? And he's just screaming and you can hear him from 200 yards away. Oh, you dumbass, you shouldn't have done that. And I would come back and I'd be like, man, I can't believe what I just saw or heard today. And he's like, well,
that's right.
There is a guide for every client and there is a client for every guide. And I was like, you mean some people like that? And he's like, yeah, some people like it. They give each other a hard time. They're ribbing each other. They're poking fun at each other, yelling at each other. And I was like, man, that sounds terrible to me. And he's like, well, that sounds terrible to me too, but some people like it. Like that guy you're talking about, he's booked all the time. Right. So, I mean, you can find like some guys that are really hard on their clients, but their clients kind of like that, right?
Yeah.
Not all of
them.
But they develop this clientele of like, oh, that's kind of how it is. You get out here, he gives you a hard time. He calls you a dumbass.
right. Exactly.
but there is a little bit of entertainment kind of that goes into some people. Like they need a little more joke telling. They need a little more storytelling. They need a little more kind of attention. And other people find that horribly annoying that the guide won't shut up.
Yeah.
How do you know which one of those people to be? Like when you were a young guide, you're going out with
somebody. I've never been that guy. I don't know. I've never been that guy. I've always been like real easygoing. And, you know, now, Now, the truth is, truth be told, I can't really say that because some of my guys, they know I abuse the hell out of them, but these are guys I've had in the boat for 20 years.
Right.
So after a while, you start getting this real comfort level with your guys and you can tell them, hey, you screwed up, man. You know, that wasn't any good. Let's not do that again. Or do you really expect that fish to eat that fly?
Yeah.
You know, that's always a great question to ask, you know?
Right.
But yeah, you know, I start off super, I'm very laid back with everybody. I don't really get into anything.
Yeah. There's a time when you can get too comfortable. Like the 20 year relationships, you know, tend to, sometimes you see it happen with certain guides and certain anglers, and sometimes they've done great in the tournament. Sometimes they're just together all the time. And then they just kind of have a breakup, you know, like
they have a divorce.
Yeah. I mean, it happens. And sometimes the guide refers to it as I had to fire him. Like, I had to fire my client, right?
Right.
But
right.
I don't know. That's a funny situation to be in, especially as a young man. Like, you're out there, you're fishing with these CEOs of these companies, and you're kind of doing this because you love what you're doing. You love it. But when this guy comes around, you don't love it. Like, and you got all these other people that are calling you. And you got this person that you fished with last time and he's last week. And he's like, man, if that other week ever opens up, count me in. And you're like, man, right. You know what? Honestly, I would be having a much better time with that other guy. And I think this guy would be having a much better time with somebody else. And so there's that difficult conversation.
I've had that three times in my life.
So. Tell me about it.
Oh God. Oh, I had a guy that, he was fantastic in his own way. I laugh about it right now, but he had a very successful business up north and came down and we were fishing together and he had already fished with seven of my good friends. Okay. Seven other guides, legit top-notch guides that knew their stuff. And so I kind of knew that I was getting into something that, you know, he had stopped fishing with each one of them. So we got in the boat and we fished together and we fished for 2 or 3 years and he was difficult, you know, difficult to handle. And like he would make a cast and I would go, oh, you know, just a sound. Oh, like that wasn't the right cast. And he kind of picked up on that. But when he made a good cast, I'd say, perfect, work that. You know, and so what he would do is that he was getting annoyed by me in the back of the boat going, oh, so every time he would make a cast and it would land, as soon as the fly would land, he'd say, perfect. So he
says
got back,
you.
So he got back at me for that one. So at the end of it all, you know, I kind of said to him, oh no, actually he broke up with me. So he actually said to me, he said, hey, I think our relationship has gone a little sour here and I go, you know what? The only regret I have is that I didn't say it first, you know, and that's it. Let him go on his way. And he went on to the next guide and the next guide and the next guide, and then finally retired from the sport. So, he just didn't get along too well.
Well, you know, he probably, just like we're saying, you know, fishing guides that are trying to get out of the fishing guide business are going to make horrible employees. He's probably an A-level, super A personality that dominates his industry and dominates his world. And he comes in and somebody's telling him what to do and he doesn't really like it.
Right, right, right. You know? And somebody's critiquing him.
Right. And they're right.
Absolutely.
What are the other two times that you've had to have that conversation?
They weren't as spectacular as that one. They didn't last very long in the boat. So it was kind of meaningless. You know, they'd come on and you could tell that you didn't click.
Yeah.
And so once that click wasn't there, you're kind of like, yeah, you know, this is an important time of year for me. I'm not going to bother with this anymore. So I just let it go.
Yeah. That's a very difficult thing for a young man. And I certainly did it the wrong way a couple of times and then maybe the right way a couple of times. And then other times it just kind of fizzles out, you know, but when you find the right one though, that's the beauty. of the whole deal. Yeah. Like when you find that one guy or a bunch of them, I mean, there could be a whole bunch of them. And then you just start to kind of, it's almost like culling in a tournament. Like you know, you're taking these days and then you're sliding like this guy into this one. And then you just keep going. And, you know, eventually you've only got like four or five customers all year long.
Exactly.
If you do it right.
Yeah. I've got 15 good ones right now and they're solid and they fill me up the entire year. So it's a good deal right now. And it's that same way, you know, they're the guys that, you know, they don't care what you do when you get on the boat. It's like, you go do what you think is going to be good.
Yeah. And that's a great position to be in, to where they know what they're getting. Mm-hmm. You know what you're going to offer and everybody's on the same page. Like, look, we're going to go out there. He's going to give it everything he's got. And I'm going to give it everything I got. And if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. Like, you know, that's the way
all you can do.
Because sometimes it doesn't happen. A lot of times it doesn't happen.
That's true.
But for the people that are coming into the sport now with Instagram and social media, it doesn't appear like it ever doesn't happen. You know what I mean?
Isn't that true?
You know what I mean? Like I follow a thousand people or more, and most of them are in the fishing world in some way, shape, or form. And it just looks like everybody's having the best day ever, every day.
Every day.
Every day. Yeah. What do you think? Yeah. Like social media has certainly changed so much of what we do. But if you, like in the span of your career, whether it's social media or another innovation, what do you think has changed fishing the most?
The GPS.
Yeah.
And then social media, but the GPS first, for sure.
When I was starting, and certainly when you were starting, you're 63. Is that what you said?
63.
You don't look 63. You're looking good.
Well, thanks, man.
I'm 53. And when both of us started, the idea of a GPS with a map on it was, the military didn't even have that. Like that was way out there. I remember the first GPS that I got. It was a Lowrance, and I think it was called an LMS 350A, and it was the shit, right? And all it could do was have a blank screen with a dot on it, and you had like four characters that you could put on that. So you would put like TP1, TP2, like TARPBN1, and there was no base map at all. And so you would be like, oh, that doesn't look like it's very far away. There was no navigate to. There was just kind of like all of a sudden you just kind of got there. So you would navigate normally. But then you would look down and you're like, oh, it looks like it's about 100 feet ahead, or, you know, 100 yards ahead or whatever. It certainly wasn't accurate to 100 feet. But yeah, that it would also get you in big trouble, because you would look like it was just right over there and you'd go. Right. And if you were looking at the thing, it'd run you straight aground, right? You couldn't possibly do that. But it has changed a lot with the advent of the GPS, especially for people that are just like learning right now because they're going only on the GPS. Right. And it's much easier as opposed to navigating by the stars at night. Sure. Right.
The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com. Knives, machetes, saws, and shears. Multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
Sure, it used to be a big deal. you know, and now people are in, well, for instance, you know, one of the first areas that I learned growing up was Hell's Bay and, you know, in Whitewater Bay.
That was the first area you learned?
That was one of the first areas.
Damn.
You
know?
Fordyce and I, as kids, were back there playing around. We had aerial photos that some dude shot from a plane.
We had these aerial photos, and
we were polling every inch of that area. And now people are going with their GPSs full throttle through all that stuff, you know, in channels. Before, we didn't have to worry because you wouldn't even hear an engine. And when you did, you kind of ducked because somebody might be coming by, you know. But now you can't even set up anywhere where there's a creek because they could run right through you. Mm-hmm. And that's just having the GPS to know how to get out.
Right.
It's not getting in. No. Getting in's no problem. It's knowing how to get out. So
you can certainly get in. Getting out is the problem. I remember the first aerial photo I saw of a place like that. And those aerial photos were gold. Like back in the day, there would be like one, or it would be hanging on the shop, you know, the fly shop wall or something of the Marquesas, and just studying that thing, like, oh my God, what if you could see like this? And I remember looking at an area like Hell's Bay and tracing with my finger. And I was like, if you were on the other side of this island, how long would it take to get to the other side of the island? And I'm tracing, this. And I'm like, oh my God, that's like a day to get 200 feet on the other side. Like, and that's how you get lost in there. Like, oh my God, you take a wrong turn and it takes you back. And you're like, I just need to be just right over there. But it's hard to get there, man.
Yeah.
It's hard to get there.
That's true.
Yeah. There have been a lot of changes. Do you think that the changes are beneficial? I mean, like, one of the questions I had for you is that you've been at this for so long that you hear people talk about the good old days. You hear people talk about how good it used to be. And then, you know, you talk to, you know, people like, I don't know, Richard Black or something. And he's like, killing it. Right. It's like, what do you think about it was better when you started, or it was better 20 years ago or than it is today? Like, what do you make of that?
You know, there are certain cases where, of course, the downtown bonefish in Isla Mirada, you know, that's something that was our fallback. Yeah. In fact, I think I started as a bonefish guide and became a tarpon guide, kind of. And because of that change in the fishing, but that kind of thing does go. And that was having to do with cold fronts and different factors, maybe water quality stuff. But right now, fishing in the backcountry is almost as good as it was when I was young. The snook and red fishing is fabulous. There's more snook now than I grew up with. There was more snook again back in 2010 before that freeze. So now they've come back. It's better again. So that fishery's better. And that's one of the things that, you know, guys like Richard are capitalizing on. And of course, he's the kind of guy, he does both things. So he goes offshore and kills it out there and just kills it in the back too. And there's a couple of guys like that. But the good old days, the good old days had less boats, and that's basically it. You know, I think if you were to cut the number of boats down, the good old days would be right back again.
Well, what about COVID? What about the year of COVID? What did you think about that?
That did it.
That was it.
That was a pure example of it. Yeah, that was a pure example of it. I mean, we were by ourselves. You know, Brewer and I would go fishing, and, you know, me and a couple of the other guides would go fishing. That's all we were doing. And then we were kind of existing off the water. There was a time where Publix didn't have any meat or any fish or anything like that. And we went out and lobstered and spearfished, and, you know, we survived off the water, which was pretty cool to do that.
Do you think that while that was going on, that you have the foresight to be like, this is the good old days? Like, man, why are we not just enjoying this? Because there was so much apprehension and anxiety about COVID and, you know, are the anglers going to come back? Are they going to close the keys? Are they like, it would be very easy to just start to subsist off the water and not realize, like, damn, this is fun. Like, this is what we used to do. Like, this is
absolutely
awesome. Like, did you have that kind of, were you having fun doing it, or were you kind of?
For sure. No, I was having absolute fun. No pressure about COVID, not thinking about a thing. Just thinking, man, the world up there is crazy, you know, and here we got a little slice of paradise, you know, where we're kind of for a while there, we were immune to everything. You know, we were just on our own. There was no COVID here. It was fantastic. It was and everybody was just coexisting peacefully and nice.
And then what happened? Then
yeah, they opened the doors and then it screwed everything up again. You know,
it's interesting where you had so many different opinions about what should happen there. Like, you have the people that are independently wealthy or retired, and they're like, no, man, close it down, keep it shut tight. We don't want anybody here. Don't let the cruise ships in. Don't let anybody in. Keep the road closed. Everything, right? And then you have people that are subsisting on tourism, and they're like, no, yeah, but we got to open it up. Like, you guys are fine, but we're dying over here. Like, this is tough. That was a tough situation for the Keys, but I don't know. It seemed like we all worked out with that. So what do you think about, I don't know, I got off track there for a second talking about COVID, because I didn't expect to talk about that.
I want to brag on you for a minute.
What?
I saw a video that you did, I think about a month ago, and you were showing a flexibility deal that you're doing,
where you're on
your knees and you're going back on your back. Uh-huh. I think that was cool as hell.
That's the lie back quad stretch.
There you go.
I have I started that because, you know, probably just like you, the time on the boat and all of the wear and tear on the body of guiding, man, I started getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And I was lifting weights and, you know, running and rowing and doing all the things that I'm supposed to do, but I'm feeling tighter and tighter and tighter. And then I hurt my back last Christmas, which I have had a on and off relationship with back injuries. Probably you have too. Most fishing guides do. Every now and then you tweak something, you know, you're throwing the cast net, you're lifting an anchor, you're putting the trailer on the truck. Something happens, lifting a heavy cooler, and all of a sudden, pow, you're like, oh, that does not feel good. And it's blowing 20 tomorrow. And guess what? You're going, right?
Right.
You're going,
right?
You can't, or there's a tournament, something, you're going, and you're going to go hurt.
I've never missed a day.
No, man, you're going hurt. You're going sick. You're going whatever. Mm-hmm. And, so I just decided I had dabbled in flexibility. Like, I had tried some yoga before, but nothing really stuck for me until I found this one guy, Joe Hippensteel. And he's got a very simple program, and like all of his, it doesn't have any kind of crazy names for his thing. He calls it like the lie back quad stretch. Like,
right,
you have the cross leg head on the floor. Like, that's another one. Like, everything he says is just like, no, there's no reason to call it like the dancing moon wolf dance. It's like just the simplest thing. So that particular one, man, I worked on that for 6 months before. I mean, I didn't have seven pillows behind my back and a pillow under my knees, and I just couldn't get in that position. And then I just kept doing it and kept doing it and kept doing it. And just like he said, you would do 2 minutes on, 1 minute off, 2 minutes on, 1 minute off. And then one day I just kind of laid back, but my knees were way off the ground. And I was like, I can't believe I'm even in this position. And when I finished that, I walked around and I was like, wow, I'm walking better. I'm sitting better. My back doesn't hurt. And so I just kept, and those things just made me spend more and more time on it. And at the first part, I was having to spend like 2 hours a day stretching. But the reason that I did that was because when I would finish, I felt so much better.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it was very painful.
No, I can imagine. I've tried it since I saw your video, and I get about Maybe if that's a clock, maybe 2 o'clock.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing to do about it, though. If you're really tight in that position, the what Joe Hippensteel says, which is absolutely the case, is don't go past a 7 in pain ever, because what happens is everything locks up. Your brain's like, no, we can't do that. And right. So it locks right. up and you're not going to get any more flexible there. So that's where you need all the pillows behind you or the couch or something to where you're getting a good stretch, but you're not hurting yourself. Right. And so then you go one pillow less and then one pillow less, and you do it over time to where he calls it a 7 in pain, to where, you know, I don't know what that would be for everyone, but you know, you're just kind of gradually mm-hmm. doing it, but you have to do it in a way to where your muscles are relaxed while you're stretching. Right. And that's what I was doing wrong for a lot of years, is I would just, you know, try to do one of these positions and I was so tight that your brain is like, nope, don't go any further than that, because that's going to mm-hmm. pop something. And, mm-hmm. you know, it locks up. Whereas if you can just go almost to that place where your leg is straight and you're stretching, but you're not going down very far, that's okay. You don't have to. Next week, you'll go a little further and a little further and a little further and a little further until all of a sudden you regain this mobility that you had as a young man. And that is what he told me right away. He's like, this is like the fountain of youth. He said, I promise you, if you stick with this, you're going to understand what I'm talking about. It's like the fountain of youth. And it took about 7 months. And then all of a sudden I was like, man, I feel 15 years younger. This is unbelievable. But you know, it's so good for injury prevention too. Like, since I started that, I haven't hurt my back again. And since I started that, I haven't had any injuries really. And it's rehabbed. Like, I had like a nagging kind of shoulder thing, and he's got some shoulder stretches, but I don't think it's just necessarily his program that is so important. It's finding a program and sticking with it. Right.
Of course.
Like, and then maybe you can start to high grade it later as you've gotten the discipline to stick with it. But at first, you just got to find something. And most people don't like the stretching.
No.
is the least kind of sexy thing, like lifting weights and running and all that stuff. That's mm-hmm. way cooler. And you can get it done in 30 minutes. The thing about the stretching is it takes a long time. Like,
first 30 minutes every day. So
does it? Yeah. What do you do?
I get up at 5:30 every morning. I'm in the gym. I have a gym downstairs, and I just go to the gym and I stretch for half an hour and then do whatever workout I'm going to do that day and try to get in a little cardio, do some boxing, do something that's, you know, cardio related. And that's my workout for the morning. I'm usually done by 7:15.
What kind of stretching are you doing? Do you have a specific routine that you're doing, or do you just kind of?
I'm doing a combination of yoga and you know, have you seen the primal flows?
No. Maybe.
I don't know. It's also called animal flows.
Okay.
And it's kind of a men's version of yoga.
Yeah.
Kind of, it's got cool names.
Yeah.
They make it cool. Like, they've got positions called the ape and the beast and that sort of thing. And I kind of got turned on to it just on YouTube, just going through the different fitness things. And I do that every day. I do a routine, a flow that they call. And you just do a couple of routines of that a day. And it just keeps you, it's strength and flexibility. Mm-hmm. So it's
obviously like, working for your tennis. When you look back on your career, did you pay much attention to fitness when you're guiding at your highest level?
Always.
You did?
Always. Yeah.
And what would
always
you do? You always worked out. Like, I remember you used to tell me that you and Rob used to work out, right?
Yeah, all the time. And he's the one that got me on the 5:30 regimen. You know, it just he started the early stuff, and now sometimes we get up as early as 4:30. You know, if we got a fishing day that day, we don't let it bother us. It's like, okay, we're going fishing, but we're going to work out first.
Now, why does that happen for you? I have an idea why it happens, but I'm serving you up a softball. Why do you get up at 4:30 with Rob and work out?
Because always something comes up in the afternoon.
Exactly.
There's never a day that something doesn't come up. These days, it's I got to show a house, or I have, you know, something to do, or your guy just wants to sit around and have a drink, you know, after fishing. And so in order to have that drink, I already worked out this morning, you know, so I'm good. I'm done with that for the day. And it keeps you moving. You know, if you know you're going to do it every day, I do it 7 days a week. I don't take days off. So it just, you know, you're going to do it, you go do it. That's it. So,
and you did that throughout your whole career?
I didn't do the early thing throughout my career. I did the afternoon thing about 3 to 4 days a week. Yeah.
Man, talk about discipline. We were talking about this the other day, I think. The discipline to get off the water in August and get off the water and put on the running shoes and then go run on the hot freaking pavement after you'd been fishing on the surface of the sun all day. That is discipline like rarely is exercised in my life, because if you walk into that air conditioning, you can totally forget about it.
You can't do it.
There is no getting out of it. It is like,
you can't sit down.
Oh my God. No. I was talking to Richard Black, actually. He's a runner, you know, and he likes to run. And I would say that I used to keep my running shoes in the car, because, and I would pull up to the house, put the running shoes on and go running before I ever even went in the house. Because if I went in that house, all the clothes were coming off and I was going to lay on the tile floor. Like,
and it's over.
Oh, it's over. You're not moving ever. No. But that's why I liked the morning better. It was cooler. You're fresh. But then it's over. You're just done with it, right? Like you got to, but to get out of the sun and then go back into the sun is, you're a tough man if you could do that.
Super tough. That's what I'm doing now with the tennis. You know, after fishing, I'm headed out to the courts usually 3 to 4 days a week. So just to get some training in.
Now, if you hadn't gotten into the tournaments for tennis, do you think that you would be able to have that kind of discipline, or is it because you have a goal now? Like you have some goals that you want to accomplish?
Absolutely. The only way you gotta, you know, how else can you set a goal? Right. I mean, for me, it's competition. So, you know, it's either competition against yourself or, something else, but it's the competition that does it. You know, you get out there and you get your ass beat one time and you're like, okay, well, I got to get better. You know, I've got to stick with it. It's going to get better. And it does.
Is the process of getting better at tennis at your age now, do you find any similarities to getting better at fishing or tournament fishing or guiding or any aspect of that?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Except that in the fishing, I never had a coach. Okay. So now I've got a coach that is taking me to the next level, stuff I've never learned about the game, about training, about mental, mainly mental.
I'm interested in that. What is he teaching you?
Oh man. Oh, so many things about thinking about the moment, being in the present, and thinking about, how your shot is going to affect the future. And I mean, we have these Zen talks all the time. He was the number one player in Thailand when he was 30, and moved to this country and became a tennis coach. And, he's done really well, and he's 72 right now, and he can kick anybody's butt. I mean, he is one of those skinny, wiry dudes that just knows the game and knows everything so well, and has the mental down, and that's a big part of every sport.
It is. It's such a big part of every sport, because once you get to a certain level, everybody can do it. Like you're talking about the Gold Cup, like or any of the Tarpon tournaments or any of the tournaments. Not every angler at these tournaments is going to be able to do it. Not every team is going to be able to do it. But there's going to be 10 at every tournament. Or five or whatever. There's going to be the teams, right? And you don't even, maybe there's 30 boats in the tournament, but you know, there's five boats you're competing with, right? And any one of those boats can do it on any day.
That's right.
And so much, and just like NBA basketball or MMA or tennis, there's anybody can win. They've got the skills to win, or they wouldn't be there. Now right. it's mental. And yep. that mental yep. aspect, the older I get, the more fascinated I am. And really, mm-hmm. this podcast was kind of born out of that. Like, I want to know what people are thinking and how they're thinking and how yeah. Just a slight tweak in the way that you're thinking can have a massive difference on your performance. And certainly yes. over time, like you always hear about the two boats that leave the harbor and they're 1 degree apart, right? And they keep going and they next thing you know, they're 300 miles apart, right? Because of that one degree, and you're going along next to this person. I always think, you know, not necessarily in competing with other people, but in competing with myself, it's like, if I could just move myself a half a degree towards the positive or towards whatever it is that I'm striving for,
right,
over time, that makes such an incredible difference.
Yeah. And what about being able to make a decision in a tournament without any repercussions, you know, with just making a decision, and if you go there and there's nothing, you're cool with that. You know, you're mm-hmm. not getting upset about it. You're not like going, oh man, not panicking and saying, well, I got to find more fish the next time. No, it's just a decision.
Right.
And then you put it away. It's done.
Well, that goes back to our conversation of how the angler and the guide are this perfect mix. And the angler yeah. is on board too. And the angler's like, look, if we go there, we might mm-hmm. knock it out of the park. And if we go there and there's nothing, hey, we swung for the That's fence. Right.
That's
we know
right.
it.
That's
right.
That's right.
Or
That's
we can
right.
play it safe and we can go to this mm-hmm. other middle ground and catch what everybody else is catching.
Right.
And you might win by a half a point or 10 points. But
right.
which one are we? Are we swinging for the fence or are we playing it safe?
That's and, right.
That's you know,
right.
that's what it is. That's so much of that can apply to so many things. And that can apply to your tennis. I mean, 100%. Yeah. You can play it safe in tennis and lose bad.
Oh, yeah.
And then absolutely. You can swing for the fence. And, you know, yeah. either it's all or nothing, you know.
Yeah,
I loved Andre Agassi's book. Have you read that?
I haven't read that.
It is.
I will now.
It is so good. And I don't know, you'll truly appreciate it now because he struggled with injuries and it would take him forever to get out of bed in the morning. And he would get going and then he was operating at the elite level of his entire career when his body was broken the most.
Wow.
And it was a mental thing. Like he wanted to be there. I'm not doing the book justice. There are so many stories in there and so many interesting things, but I'm not even a tennis player. But the way he describes tennis as being the loneliest sport in the world, that it's it's just you out there, and even different than wrestling and tennis, and I mean even different than wrestling and MMA and other individual sports, tennis is even more lonely because like at certain points, and I don't know about all tennis, but there are certain points where the crowd is not allowed, you're not allowed to get coaching. You're not allowed, your parents, the right. parents aren't allowed to right. even say, you know, do this, do that. Like, but they can yeah. in every other sport. And so, you know, you don't know, like there's just a little, these little claps and then it goes quiet. Right. And he was just talking about how lonely the sport is. And he has a whole chapter of that I had never thought about that particular sport being described as being lonely. And then it's kind of like, you know, being a fishing guide in those tournament situations can be kind of mm-hmm. lonely too, especially yeah. if you're not in sync with your angler. And then it's like, man, mm-hmm. I'm going to do this and there's going to be almost no reward if we do great, because this guy's expecting to do great,
yeah.
but he has no idea how badly this could go. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
But I love the mental aspect and,
Yeah, well, like you said, you're not a tennis player, but you got something out of that book. And there's a book, The Inner Game of Tennis, which has been used in all the sports. In fact, Tom Brady's a big proponent of it. And you'll see his focus at the football games where, you know, when the defense is playing, Tom Brady is on the sideline and he's thinking about his next four plays. Mm-hmm. And he's visualizing and going there with that. And that helps almost in everything in life.
For sure. You know,
just that whole mental aspect. And he's one of them. And there's many famous coaches that have read this book and have gone by it. And I go by it. It's the best reading I've ever done for the mental game.
Yeah, I love that, sure. Man. I love yeah. that it's, I don't know. The more I get into it, the more I get into it. It's like, I've just had several things that have happened because I've paid attention to that, and several books that I've read over time that have put me on this different path of thinking, and the results are massive. And I just look back and think, man, I wish I had known that earlier. But
yes,
I didn't. And well, that's fine.
You get to a point in your life where you know that physically you're not going to get much better. If you're training all the time and you kind of realize that, okay, this is about as good as I'm going to get, you know, at this age physically, but mentally you can always change and right. you can always get better. So it really helps that way.
That's what they say about like MMA is like, or any sport really I've heard mm-hmm. is like you take an old man's mind in a young man's body would be a very dangerous combination, right? Because the older athlete has learned all these lessons and, but their body starts to fail them. And it's like, it's almost like greatness in athletics is a combination of learning lessons fast enough to where that you can apply them to the young body. Right?
Yes.
Like you have enough wisdom, you have good coaches around you, or for some reason you've learned some things earlier than the other people. So you're applying wisdom to a young man's body with no injuries and operating at your peak, where a lot of people can still be very, very successful at an older age, mm-hmm. but it's the mind overcoming the body. Right.
Like
they have the injuries, they have these things. They're just working around them with this knowledge that they have.
Yeah,
absolutely. That's pretty awesome, man.
I think that is.
I love it. Have you read other books that, on mindset and things?
So many.
What are one or two of your favorites?
Well, one of them that comes to mind, you know, Novak Djokovic, tennis player, wrote a book on his life, and that was pretty impressive of how he overcame a lot of things and, you know, diet wise. I'm now plant based, and he went plant based, and all that the chemistry that went on there, you know, with his body and what happened and that made him stronger and wiser, sharper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I kind of learned a lot from his book and just a lot of motivational books and, you know, mindset books. And I can't think of any others that come to mind right away, but,
well, it's obviously working because you're able to apply it to a sport like tennis. And I know that you're going to have the skills and then it's going to come down to, I mean, the people that you're playing against in like that 18 and over, like everybody's got the skills. Then it's about game management and mental toughness, really. And tennis is a great sport for that. All right. Well, we're coming to a close. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I really appreciate you being on. I've been asking this question to some people and getting some interesting responses. Mm-hmm. There are non-negotiables in life, things that you're going to wake up today and you're going to get done or you're never going to do. Those are non-negotiables where before your head hits the pillow tonight, you've gotten them done or you made sure that you did not do that, right? What are your non-negotiables in life? Do you have two or three?
Well, the working out thing for sure. Non-negotiable. Got to work out every day. Got to keep your body moving. Got to make sure that, you know, it'll move the next day. And that's important. Number one thing is saying goodnight to my daughter every night. No matter where she is, we always say goodnight one way or another. So that's number one, non-negotiable. Third one, being in touch with the outdoors is my third one. No matter what I'm doing, I'm outside. So I'm rarely inside. I'm inside at the gym. That's about it. And then besides that, I'm outside, whether it's surfing or everything goes back to the water, you know. Fishing wise, it's always there. You know, so sometimes we don't mention the fishing thing as much because we know we're doing that.
Yeah.
You know, everything else is a sideline to that, but definitely something having to do with the water. Those are my three.
Nice. I love it. I love it. Paul, if anybody wants to get in touch with you, what would they do?
They can call me.
Yeah.
Or text me.
They want to buy a house. Wait, what's your phone number? You're going to leave it out there?
I don't know. Should I?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
You don't have any like crazy people out there?
There's tons of crazy people out there. Most of them listen to this show. I don't know. If you want to find Paul Tejera, he's easy to find.
They can find me on Instagram and they can DM me. How's that?
Right on. There you go. That's awesome, yeah. Man. Well, it's been awesome to catch up with you. I'm so happy for you to be experiencing this this tennis success later in life after 30 years of being off the court. That's pretty awesome, man. That really is.
Thank you.
It's just cool to see that you can make that happen at any time. You just got to get back on it and do it. Right.
Yeah. No. Well, I got a lot of great things to say about you too, and we don't have enough time, but, I love the fitness part and I love all the things that, even way back when I first saw your first, I think it was your first one and it was your 100 burpees.
Yeah.
It was one of your first videos.
Right.
And I saw that when I was like, damn, he's into this. That's good. Yeah. I like that.
I think I know the thing that you're talking about. I think it was 300 burpees and it was just me and this other dude doing burpees in the garage. And that was back when YouTube was easy because that video got like, I don't know, 600,000 views and I never did a single thing. Nothing. Nothing. I just did it. Threw it up there and I look at it one day and I'm like, what 600,000 people want to watch somebody do the same thing 300 times?
I was one of those. I watched it a couple of times for sure. You know,
I mean, seriously like, though, but now YouTube has changed, man. You can go out there with a Hollywood movie crew and you're not going to, it's tough to get 600,000 views, but back in the day, it was easy, man. You'd put anything up there. You could iron your shirt and there'd be 600,000 views. You could do anything, yeah, man. Well, awesome catching up with you, Paul. And thanks again for being on the show and we'll stay in touch.
My pleasure, man. Good talking to you.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.